God used this very element for a need that would come up later, and you'll see exactly how it gets fulfilled. Haman, it seems, was a rather resourceful man, good at getting his way, as such men usually are, the kind who can climb up to the highest offices. And so, having clawed his way up over clansmen and rivals, he ended up prime minister, second only to the king. Haman, as he is described, we said, was a clever man. But he was also a schemer, and an envious man with a very evil soul, and the rest of the story will prove it. These are the people who by every means try to rise, not caring whether they wrong others or not. And on top of that, as was in fact the protocol of the Persian court, and also something that certainly flattered the ego of those in power, the people were to bow down both to the king and to the prime minister, and all the courtiers bowed to him. For thus the king had commanded to do, because the king had given orders that not only the king but the prime minister too should be bowed to. But Mordecai, who it seems was based in the royal court, did not bow to him. He would not bow down to Haman, and it seems that whenever he saw Haman coming from a distance, he wouldn't stay in the welcoming party, but would find some excuse to slip away, so as not to bow to Haman. Now, he didn't do this. As we'll see quite clearly later on in the prayer, Mordecai offers to God. He didn't do it out of pride, the way many people vanish from the presence of some official who is their enemy, so as not to have to greet him. That is a familiar thing. So he didn't do it to avoid bowing out of pride, thinking, I have a first cousin who is queen, and now I'm supposed to bow to the prime minister. And who is he anyway? Mordecai did not do it out of that kind of pride, but out of an entirely good disposition. You see, we were in an idolatrous atmosphere. Kings were not bowed to as a mark of honor, but in worship. Remember, when the three young men in Babylon were told to bow to the golden image of King Nebuchadnezzar, now, bowing down does appear in the Old Testament. We find it very often, men bowing to the king, or to other officials, bowing right down to the ground, kneeling and doing obeisance. But with that bowing in the Old Testament, for the one bowing and for the one being bowed to alike, it never once entered anyone's mind that the act could carry a dimension of worship, the way God is bowed to and worshipped. It never crossed their minds. But now, finding themselves in an idolatrous setting, as you can appreciate, the situation is different. Those who are bowed to in worship, because the kings were treated as gods. So when Haman demanded to be bowed to by his subjects, he was demanding it, mind you, more or less as though he were God. How could such a thing ever sit with the good conscience of a genuine Hebrew, to bow to a man? Doesn't the commandment say, the Lord your God only shall you worship, and him only shall you bow to? So how now was he to bow to a man? And yet, so as not to give any occasion, let's not forget, he is a captive. They are now in Susa, because they had passed through many masters. First, they were captives of the Assyrians, the northern kingdom, then of the Babylonians. And now, once these two empires had fallen as well, it is Persia that stands at center stage in history. It is Persia. So they find themselves in a setting where they cannot do otherwise. By every means, they try to avoid giving any occasion for offense. That is what Mordecai did. He held back. He tried not to make himself a target, and to Haman. At least he gave no target. A whole crowd of people are welcoming some official personage. Now that official will take note of who greets him and who does not. And the courtiers did bow down before him. The courtiers bowed to him, and they noticed that Mordecai would not stand and bow before Haman. And they say to him, Mordecai, why do you disobey what the king commands? Mordecai, why do you break the king's orders to bow to Haman? Every day they spoke to him. Day after day, they kept telling him this, and in spite of it all, Mordecai had said one thing, that I am a Jew, and Mordecai made it clear that he is a Jew. That is, that his own law, the law of God, does not permit him to bow to men. Still, it seems the courtiers thought about it in various ways. Why should this one be exempt from bowing while we bow, out of ambition? And second, they probably wondered whether Mordecai's motive might in fact be a good one. Indeed, because he would not want to make a god of a man. All of this, and whatever else, led the courtiers to report to Haman that Mordecai does not bow to him. And it was from this incident, my beloved, that the whole story written here in the book of Esther began. This was the crux of it, to bow or not to bow, because if Mordecai had bowed to Haman, how would the story have unfolded from there? And how would we have the book of Esther today? This wonderful book, If the three young men and Daniel had bowed to the golden image of Nebuchadnezzar, how would we have that miracle of their not being burned when they were thrown into the fiery furnace? Someone might ask, why do I say this? And why is it important? Someone might say, but my good man, what is so important about this? It is an important thing, my beloved. It truly is. A man once, and he isn't here. And what I'm about to tell you is to his credit, went to file a matter at a notary's office on behalf of a friend about a pension. His friend hadn't told him he would have to take an oath. Even so, he grew suspicious and kept asking the notary, will I have to take an oath? And the notary said, yes, but it is nothing serious. You'll just put your hand here on this gospel. Ah, no, he says, no, I won't be able to take an oath. But my poor man, says the notary, it is nothing serious. It is just a little book. Listen to that. It is just a little book. Forgive me, he says to the notary. It is not a little book. It is the gospel. Then the notary says, forgive me. I respect your principles, and I admire you. You see, sometimes it is a small incident, and a whole story can begin from it. It doesn't matter how small. The faithful man is faithful, even in the small incident, as the Lord says. He who is faithful in little is faithful also in much. So Haman found out that Mordecai does not bow. This turned him into a beast. He does not bow to me. You know how it is. People who hold high offices and take on a terrible arrogance cannot bear, deep down, for anyone to create situations of disobedience toward them. And for that very reason, he wanted to do away with Mordecai. But two things could have been at play here. Either he could not do away with Mordecai directly, since Mordecai too was inside the palace. And what pretext could he find? How could he arrange it? Or he wanted to wipe out all the Jews, so that under that cover he could destroy Mordecai as well, and at the same time take revenge on the whole race of the Hebrews. You'll ask me, was it ever really possible for a whole people to be wiped out over the hatred or the envy, mainly hatred here, over the hatred of one man? If we read the histories of the peoples of the East, the thing is not rare at all. Yes, my beloved, it is not rare at all, and so you won't think this is only something from long ago. Let me tell you just this. I don't know what Hitler may have had against a handful of Jews. I don't know how many great bankers, prominent, powerful men. What do I know? 5, 10, 50, 100. What did he decide? To wipe out all the Jews, and not just the Jews of Germany, but the Jews of the lands he occupied. From Greece, too, he rounds up the Jews. So you see that these things Scripture tells us, which sometimes strike us as historical myths. And we think, how could it possibly be? We have them in our own age, too. And now imagine wanting to wipe out the entire race of the Hebrews across the whole vast Persian Empire, purely and simply to take revenge on Mordecai. Strange, and yet true. Now, the idolaters, whenever they were about to make a decision, were always people who wanted to have a corresponding favor, a consent from the gods. This is why so many of the idolaters were superstitious. And Haman did something along these lines here. What did he do, do you think? He decided to cast lots to see at what time his plan would succeed. They would go to the statue of the goddess Fortune, and there they would cast lots, so that the goddess Fortune might reveal the favorable moment when people ought to carry out some undertaking of theirs. And so you won't think this too is strange and peculiar. Let me tell you that Hitler, as well, asked the magicians surrounding him when he should begin the war, when to strike Russia, and his magicians told him, in August. And when the fighting began, we were heading into winter, not into spring. Hitler reached the very outskirts of Moscow, but winter overtook him. And should anyone say he had no historical precedent? In fact, Hitler had the historical precedent of the great Napoleon, and he suffered the very same thing. Come now, was there not a single general to tell him that what he was setting out to do was reckless, because they would never manage to reach Moscow in time? My dear friends, the magicians had their say. And magicians are a terrible thing. You know how people begin their ventures, their affairs, their business dealings, their marriage, and a whole host of other important things in their lives on the basis of such superstitious signs, with the coffee cup, with the cards, with palmistry, with going off to consult a medium. And the ancient Greeks, what did they ever begin without asking the oracle at Delphi? What did they undertake? They undertook nothing. And of course, you know what lies at the bottom of all this? It is man's need to make his course depend on God. But he has lost the true God. And having lost the true God, he falls into substitutes. And the substitute is magic. And what does the Christian do? He too does not simply do whatever comes into his head. He too asks God. How does he ask him? He does it readily in his prayer. He goes to his spiritual father. He asks God to show him how he ought to act. He says, Lord, this is what I am thinking of doing. Will you bring it to a good end? Do you will it? I entrust it into your hands. If you will it, prosper it. If you do not will it, do not prosper it. The spiritual man, the faithful one who knows the true God. This is what he does. The other man too does this. The one who does not know the true God, but through the substitutes, as I told you. Through magic. So this, now, is exactly what Haman does as well. They place lots beneath the hand of the goddess Fortune to see at what time they must act in order to succeed in the extermination of the Jews. Do you know what month it was? It was the first month of the year for the Jews, the month of Nisan. But do you know when the lot fell? On the 14th of the last month, the month of Adar, which means that it was nearly a whole year, less about 15 days perhaps, before this plan of Haman's could be carried out and the Jews destroyed. It is immediately plain that this was the providence of God. You will say to me, my dear friends, when people cast dice, cast lots, and even consult the coffee cup, and many other such things. God can direct these things, provided that what people are pondering in this way are matters that belong to God, then God most certainly directs them. See where the lot fell, the time ran out, a whole year. That is the first thing. And second, when people plot to do evil, and God wills to let that evil come to pass, how then does God act? He gives them over to a spirit of delusion, so that those people fail, so that the very thing they sought does not turn out as they sought it, but instead turns against them for their harm. He gives them a spirit of delusion, while they set out convinced that what they are doing is right. And so, if you please, the lot fell a year later, and therefore, the slaughter of all the Jews was to take place in the year 473 BC. But in order for Haman to do this, he had to have the king's approval. Now, how is the approval to come about? How is he to obtain it? When a man is a schemer, when he wants to bring off a plan, when he knows how to work his way in, may God never, my dear friends, permit me to become the object of the malice of powerful men. May God not permit it, for no one can escape except from the hands of God. He goes to the king and says to him, You know, O king, there is a certain nation scattered among the nations throughout your whole kingdom. And indeed the Jews were scattered, dispersed throughout the whole vast Persian realm. Their laws are strange, unlike those of every other nation. Their laws, their legislation, are strange. Now, strange in the old sense means something else, something other, something different. That is, they have different laws, laws that do not resemble our own. But there is also a modern sense. And I fear that here the word carries the modern sense too, meaning absurd things. That is, their laws are absurd. And this I tell you of my own accord, O king, that this nation disobeys even your own laws, and it is not to the king's advantage to let them be. And it is not to the king's advantage to leave them alone. So now the insinuation begins, the poisoning of the mind. He now tells the king what he must do. You see, it is not to the king's advantage to leave these people be. For this reason, O king, I have come to give you a piece of advice. Destroy them. These men ought not to be citizens of your kingdoms, for they are dangerous men, they are rebels. And when we destroy them, into the royal treasuries I will pay for you 10,000 talents of silver. Do you know how much that is? 10,000 silver talents. The talent held 6,000 gold drachmas, Attic drachmas. That is 240 gold sovereigns. That is one talent. And so 10,000 talents is exactly like the parable of the servant's debt. It comes to 2,400,000 gold sovereigns. And as Herodotus preserves for us, this sum was one-third of the entire state budget. So you can understand what it meant for such a sum to fall into the king's treasuries. But how was this sum to be raised? The very men who carried out the killing would seize it from the estates of the Jews. Exactly what happened with the Germans as well, who seized the estates of the Jews, and then killed the Jews themselves. Haman would do precisely the same thing. This pleased the king. From what point of view? From the point of view of the money, at least, as the king will say a little further on, and from the point of view that he might otherwise have rebellious citizens, which of course is not to his advantage. "Very well," he says to him. The king slips off his ring. "Take it." For the king's ring was the seal of the state. "Take my ring," he tells him. "Draw up the relevant decree and seal it. As for the money you mentioned, we have no need of it." It was a way for Xerxes to show that he was above money. But as regards the peoples, keep the silver and do with the nations as you please. The money he waved aside, of course, for Haman would rake in far more. He said he would deposit such a sum in the king's treasuries. But how much would he himself gather, as regards the peoples? Do with them as you please. A terrible thing. Use them as you please. Freely, do whatever you want. Just imagine, a state of justice. Do whatever you want with these peoples. What a terrible thing. See, my dear friends, what a phase humanity has passed through in its history, phases of barbarism and savagery. And then the king's scribes were summoned to draw up the decree, which was sent out from India, where the realm of the Persians reaches all the way to Ethiopia in Africa, a vast realm. There were 127 provinces under the dominion of Xerxes. I will read you very quickly the letter they sent, the decree. The author of the book preserves it for us. It does not appear that the author is Mordecai himself, for he was right in the thick of things, and so had a copy in hand, as we shall see further on where it tells how he obtained it, so that later he could write this book. The decree would be carried by the couriers so that it would swiftly reach its destination. Just think of it. From the Indies, with Susa in the middle, the capital of the Persians of Persia. On the one side lie the Indies, and on the other, in Africa, lies Ethiopia. It was the first state in the world to establish an organized postal service. The postal system of the Persians was truly remarkable. The couriers, who were called letter bearers, would set out. They had relay stations. They would take up the mail and then ride at full speed, on horseback, that is, covering a set distance. There they would leave the horse, take a fresh, rested horse, and press on to the next station, and so on and so forth. In this way, with the utmost speed, all the royal orders reached the farthest edge of that vast realm. I tell you this because there was, in fact, a beautiful saying preserved for us by Herodotus about the couriers of Persia, one that it would be very fitting for the postal workers of every nation to adopt. And, this will seem strange to you, for missionaries as well. Why? Because it said that the mail, the message, simply had to arrive, whether it was night or day, whether cold, whether winter, whether summer. It was, we might say, the inscription on which the foundations of the Persian postal system rested, and the missionaries, too, cold, heat, day, night, the word of God must run, like the post. And so the purpose of the document was that the order be carried out. Note this, within a single day, the Jews had to be killed, and you will see below why, and all their possessions plundered. So listen to the letter, I will read you the translation, so that I can explain the text to us. The great King Xerxes commands as follows, to the rulers and satraps under his authority over the 127 provinces that stretch from the land of India as far as Ethiopia, although I am ruler over many nations, says the king, and I have become lord of the whole world. I did not wish to govern you by boasting or abusing my power out of hypocrisy, but by carrying out this administration always with fairness and gentleness. In exercising my authority, I wish to make the life of my subjects always calm and untroubled. I make my kingdom gentle and secure to its farthest lands so that the peace all people long for may flourish. What beautiful words, one might say, and beneath the beautiful ones the crime lies hidden. Do you see? I am a gentle king. I want my subjects to have peace. These are the kinds of things politics will say too. But further down he will show what he means, that a whole people is to be exterminated. Having asked my counselors how this could be brought about, one of them, named Haman, who surpasses the others in wisdom, and who is known for his unchanging devotion and steadfastness toward me, and who holds the second place within my kingdom, made known to us that among all the tribes of the inhabited world, a certain troublesome people has been scattered, a people which by its laws stands opposed to every nation and always transgresses the decrees of kings, in such a way as to hinder the full harmony of the empire which we govern. We have learned then that this people alone stands in opposition to the whole human race, separating itself from it by strange laws, and that it is ill-disposed toward our interests, commits the utmost evils, and thus hinders the stability of my kingdom. We have therefore ordered that the proscribed Jews, those named by this decree, which was drawn up by Haman, and by whom will it be drawn up? By Haman it will be drawn up, who is at the head of the affairs of the state, and holds the position of our second father. I desire, I say, that all of them, together with their wives and their children, be destroyed, root and branch. Do not leave even a root. Listen, please, root and branch. Down to the very root, says the holy text, by a hostile sword, without pity and without sparing, without your feeling any sorrow or compassion. And when will this happen? On the 14th day of the 12th month, Adar, of the present year. A terrible thing. I desire these things to happen, so that these men who in the past and in the present are enemies may all go down on the same day by a violent death into Hades, and so provide, for the times to come, stability and peace for my state affairs. As if anyone could ever have stability and peace by committing crimes like these. So you see how nicely the slaughter gets dressed up and carried out in the name of peace. Tell me, please, and yet how many times, even today, do we copy this very same tactic? In the name of peace, we wage military campaigns. What shall I bring up for you? Since I never want to say things from contemporary history too pointedly, everyone understands how it is today with those peoples who go and strike, who seize another. And when you press them on it, it is to secure the peace. They say, that is what they do. The same spirit. You see, politics has not changed. Its spirit is always the same. Only one thing changes. The manner, the methods. And in our age, it has become a true science, a science of evil. The politicians of our age have become masters of very great evil. Many copies were made, translated into the 127 languages, and sent out by the couriers, and all the nations were ordered to be ready on the appointed day to kill the Jews. And the matter was hastened in Susa as well. Within the capital, too, the thing was put into effect, and there most of all, within the capital, because Haman's plan was to do away with Mordecai as well, above all Mordecai. But what happened? Let me read you the phrase, and you will see what happened. And the king within Susa, the king and Haman, sat drinking. But the city was in turmoil. Two extremes. When the city learned of it, the whole of it was in turmoil. First of all, the Jews were troubled. They were troubled exceedingly. Then those who loved the Jews were troubled. And then all the inhabitants were troubled. Some a little, some a great deal, because it was never possible for them to look upon slaughters before their eyes and find it a pleasant sight. Two men are making merry, the king and Haman, notice the contrast. They were carousing, it says. The word comes from a verb connected to the kothon, which is a cup. To put it plainly, it means to drink cup after cup. The kothon was a large cup from which they used to drink wine. So kothonizo means, as we say today, he is a drinking man. Of course, the word does not carry that exact sense. But that is how the people put it, he is of the drink. That is, he is the man of the bottle. So then, they were carousing means they were drinking wine in large cups. That is, they were reveling. Why were they reveling? What are the people doing outside? Lamenting. And what are these two doing? Reveling here. Of course, we see, first of all, the wicked, when they look upon evil, they take pleasure in it. And they take delight in evil. It gives them pleasure. This calls to mind the case of Herod, when the Magi arrived in Jerusalem and asked where the king of the Jews was to be born. Remember what the evangelist Matthew writes. The city of Jerusalem was troubled. Why was it troubled? Do you know why? Because Herod was a bloodthirsty man, he had already given many earlier examples of massacres. And so, when the people heard that a king of the Jews was being born, that is, a descendant of David, they shuddered and said, "What a terror! We are going to have slaughter again." And the people were thrown into turmoil. Herod took pleasure in butchering by every means. When he slaughtered the infants of Judea, of Bethlehem, and of the surrounding region. What do you think? Was he not pleased? When he had done that, my beloved Herod went so far as to kill his own wife and to kill his own child. Herod killed two of his own children. He was a terrible man. Well then, the very same thing is happening here too. The people are grieving while the king and the prime minister are making merry. But there is something else as well. Something else that is cunning. Do you know who it is that keeps him entertained? The prime minister. and why? So that the king would be led astray, and would not perceive the mourning of the people, and might not perhaps reconsider his decree. For there was something dreadful about this too. A whole year had to pass, and the king was not to become aware of the people's reaction. And the prime minister, in this case, is a court flatterer who tries to draw the king into this wicked scheme. A scheme that served not the interest of the kingdom, but his own personal interest. How many such things happen, my dear ones? How many such things happen, and will always happen, as long as there is human history? Mordecai, too, came to learn of it. He learned of it. The moment this man learned of it, he understood at once that the one who had drafted this decree was Haman. And then he tore his garments, clothed himself in sackcloth, and put ashes upon his head, a sign of mourning, for it was not he alone who was in danger, the whole Jewish people was in danger. And he did something else as well, which I do not know. My dear ones, whether it had its like in that age, in our own age we do have something similar. In that age, as Mordecai did under the political conditions that had arisen there, after he had torn his clothes, put on sackcloth, and placed ashes on his head. He went out into the city square, and what did he do? He cried out, he shouted with a loud voice, and what was he saying? A nation that has done no wrong is being destroyed. A whole people is about to be slaughtered, though it is guilty of nothing. Now, how will you take this as a passive show of resistance, or an active one? Both. What Mordecai did is deeply important. It was a demonstration. We can picture demonstrations as we understand them today. The kind of demonstrations people hold when something is going wrong with those who govern, and the people mount a protest. They go out into the streets, they raise banners, they shout, they march beneath the windows of the palace, of the government house, of the prefecture, whatever it may be, they shout. They protest against that measure, which the state has ordered. Can you conceive of this in antiquity, and indeed in the Persian state, in this very capital of the Persian state, with a king such as Xerxes was? Only conceive of it. I do not know. I have not made a historical study of all these matters. I suspect that Mordecai may be the forerunner of today's mass rallies. So I suspect, and it is very significant. Indeed, today some do the very same thing, good or bad, bad for certain, because the point they reach is no good thing, setting themselves on fire. They go into the square. In the middle of the square, they soak their clothes with gasoline, set them alight, and are consumed. It is a terrible thing, it is suicide, and it is no way to protest, yet it is a kind of protest. This is called the passive way. Mordecai was not killed, he did not take his own life. And besides, who would pay any heed to a captive? Say a captive had killed himself. Well, so what? Who cares? The Persians would say. The Persian court. He demanded nothing. That is not the point. The point is this. On the one hand, he creates a passive resistance by wearing old clothes and putting ashes and the like on his head in order to draw the attention of the crowd. Notice this, to draw the attention of the crowd. But he does something more as well. He cries out, he shouts with a loud voice, and he lays the problem before the ears and the eyes of the Persian people. He reached the palace, right up to the door, outside. He came there to protest. Bold. Now this is no longer passive resistance. It is dynamic. It is active resistance. As I told you, it makes an impression on us. It astonished me when I saw it. And he came as far as the gate of the king and stood there. From the square he went to the gate of the palace. And there he stood and shouted. But what could have happened? Could they ever have let him inside? He wanted to go in. How could he go in? Would they ever allow it? For it was not permitted to him. That is, he was not allowed to enter the court wearing sackcloth and ashes. He could not go in that state, protesting, into the royal palace. They block him, they stop him outside. Do you see, I ask you, the courage of this man? It leaves us astonished. Astonished. But at the same time, the signal, of course, was given by Mordecai there in Susa. At the same time, both from the signal of Mordecai's example, and from the content of the decree, a great lamentation began throughout the whole empire, weeping, wailing, and cries. And in every province where the letters were published, there was crying and lamentation and great mourning among the Jews. They spread out sackcloth and ashes for themselves. They too mourn in the same manner. They too put on sackcloth and ashes on their heads, and they lie on the ground to protest against this decree. I do not know, my beloved, whether the Jews would have done this if Mordecai had not begun it. The queen's maidservants went and told her, told Esther. And when Esther heard of this decree, she was troubled. And still more, when she learned that Mordecai was outside protesting in this way, she was troubled. And then she sent her servants to clothe him and to bring him inside, but he would not be clothed. "No," he says, "I will stay here in my sackcloth outside the door, and I will keep crying out." Then Esther, since Mordecai would not come inside, with an unimaginable determination, calls one of the eunuchs, Hathach. And she says to him, "Please, go to Mordecai and find out exactly what is happening, what this whole affair is." And then Mordecai tells the eunuch to report to the queen that Haman is planning to destroy the people of the Jews, to seize their possessions, and to put them into the royal treasury, into the king's coffers. "And what is more, I even have a copy of the decree," says Mordecai. "Take it and give it to the queen so that she may read it." He does not go inside. He stays outside in his sackcloth garb. And what is more, he gives a charge to the queen, who does. Mordecai, and what was she to him? His cousin. And he says to the eunuch, "Tell her to go in and plead with the king to petition him on behalf of the people, remembering the days of her lowliness, how she was raised up and nourished by my hand. For Haman, the man second to the king, has spoken against us and doomed us to death. Call upon the Lord and speak to the king on our behalf and deliver us from death." I send her word, she is to go in to the king, into the audience hall, and tell him the whole matter, so that he may deliver us from the slaughter. Let the queen not forget who she once was, a poor girl, a captive, and God helped her rise to the royal office. Let her remember that it was I who took her in and raised her. Tell her all this, and let the queen pray that we may be saved. Here we see two things. The first is that he reminds her of her humble origin. The second is that she should pray. When a person comes to hold high office, he forgets what he once was. Sometimes poor relatives go to a rich man, a relative, you see, who has now grown wealthy, and he may say, "Ah, I don't know you, I've never seen you. Where do I know you from? Where have I seen you?" That is why Mordecai reminds her of what? Of her poor origin. Do not forget where you come from. Do not forget that it was I who raised you. You see the boldness. "And you shall go in to the king to ask of him what you have been told. And secondly, you shall pray." So then, what does he ask of the queen? Humility and prayer. Humility and prayer, a great lesson. The moment is critical, my dear friends. And now, listen to this. When Hathach the eunuch went in and told her everything, Esther found it hard to accept what Mordecai was instructing her to do. Why did she find it hard? Not because she had forgotten her humble origins. No. As for her prayer, we will come to that later. But what was it? Listen. "Go and tell Mordecai," she says to her eunuch. And this indeed is something Herodotus too tells us very clearly, and we have a further testimony to show for it, that all the nations of the kingdom know that any man or woman who goes into the king, whoever enters the inner court uncalled, there is no deliverance for him, except the one to whom the king extends the golden scepter, that one shall live. And I have not been called to come in to the king for these 30 days. Everyone knows it. All the peoples under the king know it. Whoever enters the inner court, into the king's private chambers, without the king summoning him, is in danger of being put to death, and even the queen herself. Remember how I told you in an earlier talk that the queen was not like a queen today, who has equal rights with the king. The queen was, in reality, a slave. The king was an absolute monarch. And I have not been called by the king for 30 days. Why 30 days? For a whole month, Queen Esther had not been summoned to his chambers, because it seems there was perhaps some coldness, some displeasure. The king may have had something against Esther and did not call her. Besides, he had many women in his harem, in his women's quarters, and so he did not summon the queen for 30 days, and therefore her answer is this. "What are you telling me, to go and say this to the king? Do you not know that if I go in without being summoned, he will kill me? Do you not know this?" In other words, "I am in danger. I cannot do this thing." The eunuch comes and tells this to Mordecai. Mordecai answers her. Please listen to the answer of a faithful man and a hero who loves his homeland. "Go," he says to Hathach, "go and tell her, Esther, do not say to yourself that you alone in the kingdom will be saved out of all the Jews." The fact that he puts her name first is to address her by name, Esther, do not tell yourself that everyone will be destroyed and you alone will be saved. Do not say that. It is what some people say. Ah, who cares? What does such a one say? My homeland is in danger, my village, Greece. Ah, who cares? Let me just gather my gold coins, gather my gold, buy houses, buy plots of land. Who cares, you wretched man? When the homeland is destroyed, will you be saved? Will you be saved? A fine point, then, a powerful argument, namely, that she should not say that she will be saved while the others are destroyed, or that the others will be destroyed while she is saved. And further, if you keep silent at this time, help and protection will come to the Jews from another quarter. But you and your father's house will perish, if you do not heed my word to go into the king and ask him to save us. Mark this. God, we have the historical experience, Mordecai would be telling her. I know it from the history of our people. God will find a way to save us. But you and your father's house, your family, because you betrayed your people, in not helping them, you will be destroyed, and God will save us, even if you do not do this so that we may be saved. And then a third argument, and these were powerful arguments. These arguments shook Esther to the core. And who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Who knows if you were raised up to be queen precisely for this very moment? For who were you? Who were you? A poor young girl. And what happened? You became queen. So then, on the one hand, you became queen. But how do you know that God was not preparing you to become queen for this difficult moment? This last argument of his was tremendously important. And as events themselves proved, it is the theology of history. We can see this matter far more deeply. It is precisely for this reason that God, in his long-sighted providence for his people, raised Esther up as queen so that the people might be saved. In the same way, with the same far-seeing providence, God prepared Moses to be saved from the waters of the River Nile, to become the child of Pharaoh's queen, to become a royal son, precisely so that by the hand of Moses, God might save his people Israel. This is the theology of history. This, my dear ones, is exactly how we can learn to see things. God works with a far-seeing gaze. Yes, and Esther has no objection, she yields. Mordecai is right. Of course, she had had an argument of her own, just as we often have an argument ready to say the opposite. But what is an argument, after all? An argument is simply an argument, nothing more. But now, here, Esther will speak, and she does it in a courageous way. She says to the eunuch, "Tell Mordecai this. Tell him that all the Jewish residents in Susa are to fast on my behalf. I am going into the king, and for 3 days you shall neither eat nor drink. Fast for 3 days and pray for 3 days. And I too, together with my whole retinue, that is, all my maidservants, will fast for 3 days and pray earnestly to God. And only then will I go in to the king. I will go in without being summoned, and if he is going to destroy me, then let him destroy me. Together with the people of God, heroism, sheer heroism, my dear ones." This was the resolve with which Esther faced it. A great woman, a very great woman, and now she fasts and she prays. The people of God fast and pray, and Esther with them. You see here how prayer and fasting are about to storm the wall that goes by the name of Haman and Xerxes. The strongholds will fall. They will be brought down by the fasting and the prayer of the people of God. You have seen the power of prayer and of fasting. But I will continue, my dear ones, this coming Wednesday.